Good morning. I'm Ann Schindler, and this is First Coast Connect. Today, St. Augustine leads the pack among cities vying to host the state's Museum of Black History. We talk to two people driving that effort. Later in the program, FSCJ becomes one of just three Florida schools to partner with the State Department on research as part of its diplomacy lab. But first, not even a burning bus could stop First Coast residents hoping to bring the state's Black History Museum to St. Augustine. We're joined on the line by one of those determined passengers who was on that bus, Pastor Anthony Britton of New Mount Moriah Christian Ministry. Good morning, Pastor Britton.
Good morning.
I'm also joined here in studio by St. John's County Administrator Joy Andrews, who has been working on this project for months. Welcome, Joy.
Thank you. Good morning.
It's so nice to have you. So, Pastor Britton, we'll get to the museum in just a minute, but let's start with a little explanation of that bus. Where were you headed and what exactly happened?
So we was on our way to Tallahassee to stand behind Joy and our county commissioner to say that we, the residents of St. John's County, are a very diverse group of people. We're in support of the state of Florida bringing the museum. So we headed up I-10. It's about 6:15 in the morning. We are going, we dressed in our shirts, saying that we are from St. John's County and we want this museum to be brought here. And to show, to demonstrate, not just to say it, but to demonstrate that we are committed to the cause. The work has been done by the county and our leaders. The negotiations and the process have been done, but the people rallied together and said that we want to go and show that board that we are committed to this as residents of St. John's County.
Right on. And then your bus caught on fire.
The bus caught on fire. I was asleep, right? And we thought it was a flat tire. The bus driver, we still don't know exactly what the flat tire engine failure, but the gentleman did a great job of pulling the bus over. And then there was smoke, you know, like we have a flat tire. And there's a couple of folks, and there's smoke back here, and they begin to get off kind of slowly. The bus driver gets off. He comes back, get off the bus now. And now there's 54, 55 people on this bus, seniors, 90, 80, 70 plus years old, and still didn't know the sense of urgency. And so then we was able to begin to get people off. And now the people coming off the bus begin to see the fire bills and bills and bills. So now it becomes a real sense of urgency, and it's still dark outside. And so that's what happened. There's more to tell, but that's what happened initially.
Nobody injured.
Nobody injured. Praise God. A couple of folks with some smoke inhalations. One of our members, Ms. Mildred Williams, she's 92. She fell kind of just a little bit, right? But she went and got checked out and she's fine. No injuries to the 55-plus passengers nor the bus drivers. And that's a miracle. It's almost like God said, okay, I'm going to put myself on the agenda. I'm going to show that I'm with you guys. And that fire, if you've seen the videos, that fire was contained to the back of the bus, and it couldn't go forward. The smoke inside, there's some pictures I saw yesterday, before and after pictures. During that time, the smoke was so thick that people could literally see their hands. There was a Marine named Kenny Ginn. He was the last person. He's 6'8". So he's sitting in that last seat where he can stretch out. He had to put his hands in each seat to make sure that nobody was sitting there because he couldn't see. And there was people still sitting there, and he would not let them. You know, the Marines got a thing. You don't leave nobody behind. He would not let them stay on that bus. And he made sure that they got off. He was the last person to get off.
My goodness.
It's just an amazing story. Amazing story. I still get teared up about it today.
Joy, we're talking about a determined group of people, I would say.
We are.
A bus full. They were not deterred.
No, nothing. Nothing will deter this community.
Yeah. So you got a call about that. You were already in Tallahassee.
I arrived the night before just to make sure, and just to wake up to a call around 6:15. Actually, Vicky Pepper, who was one of the activists from the area, she was on the bus, and she texted me first and said, Joy, we're on fire. The bus is on fire. I say, yay, we're on fire. She said, no, the smoke is coming out. We are literally on fire. And so I started calling everybody. Everybody was in panicking just to make sure that nobody's hurt. And I end up calling Sheriff Rob Harwick. I said, Sheriff, we need help. We need people can take our people to Tallahassee. We are waiting for them. We have 57 excited residents who want to be there. Sheriff answered a call and found all these variation of caravans and different deputy cars and SUVs, and they made their way from the burning site outside of, I think it's McKelney.
McKelney, yeah.
And to Tallahassee right on the same time we started a presentation. Of course, our task force members were amazing. They were so agreeable. They waited until almost the time for their arrival to start St. John's County's presentation. So that was quite a scene to see. We were joking amongst ourselves. St. John's County cannot go anywhere without a big production. We can't even plan for it.
It's a grand entrance. Yeah. But the task force, those are the ones who are deciding where the museum goes. Were they aware of what you'd gone through to get there?
We let them know ahead of time, but I mean, of course, we only were able to let them know around 9 o'clock when we arrived at the venue, which is the Department of State's auditorium.
Yeah, wow. So let's talk about the pitch. So you were there. There were other local officials in attendance. There was this big crowd from St. John's County. Why is it so important to people in the county to have the state's Black History Museum there in St. Augustine?
Well, when we learned, of course, Commissioner Whitehurst and Commissioner Arnold, Chairwoman Arnold, were there. And so we have been involved with this process, I would say, little less than a year ago. When we learned that there is a provision in our current state law that a location is to be identified to place the future Florida State Black History Museum, we immediately start to talk with our residents in West Augustine area. We started to engage our conversation with Florida Memorial University. We thought there is no other place. There is no other place is more suitable for a state Black History Museum than St. John's County, than in right in West Augustine and right on the educational campus where it used to be the Florida Memorial College and then later to be changed to Florida Memorial University. It was one of the first comprehensive education institution for the African Americans and for the Black residents at the time. And it was a thriving college until the Civil Rights Movement. And the president at the time, because of the tension in the community, and really just there was a lot of riots. There was fire. There was literally the campus was burned down. So they decided to move to Dade County in the 60s. So when we start to connect the dots of the history of St. Augustine, St. John's County, we felt this is a must story of redemption. And it's going to be such an amazing opportunity for us to honor the pain, but also the resilience of the Black community.
So that was a Black college, now a Black university. But it is an extraordinary thing to think of a university actually picking up and leaving a city because racial hostility is so intense.
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. It was really a demonstration of bravery for them to start to engage this conversation with us and put the trust back to say that, well, we can return home. We think we have the community who is behind us, who has our back, and they're willing to explore. And they really, during the presentation at the Tallahassee Task Force last Friday, I read in its entirety the letter from the chairman, Bill McCormick, of the Board of Trustees of the university. It was a moving moment. And really just kind of the sentiment, the entire university and the community of the alumni and how they are showing that their willingness to reconcile and to be seen as kind of the staple of this legacy is incredible.
It's interesting that the museum has kind of this larger ability to maybe heal or at least, you know, try to atone for what happened. I don't think many people even know the story of that.
We didn't until we really started to talk with them and then we started to do research. Of course, we know the rich history of St. Augustine in general. You know, we have the first recorded black baby that was born in St. Augustine in United States of America. And we have the first the free settlement of the Formosa. And it is now, from the 1700s, I think it's 1738. And it is under reconstruction by the Florida State Parks Foundation as we speak. So we have so much to celebrate. The Kenry House, it was a house that was in the south part of the county that was shot during the civil rights movement when Dr. Martin Luther King visited. So the county made tremendous investment to preserve that house and currently is in the move, literally in the move from south part of the county to be moved to be adjacent to the Florida Memorial University Arch on West King. So that add to, close to 30, really, I think, historical assets that shows our Black history.
Pastor Britton, I want to bring you back into the conversation. I mean, we're talking about a community effort to bring this museum to town, and it's regarded as a victory and an asset. But obviously, it opens up a lot of painful stories for St. Augustine and St. John's County.
It does. And at the same time, what an opportunity to allow the healing to take place with us coming together. I mean, so many people did so much in preparation. And even that with the bus on fire, Baker County Sheriff's Office, their fire department, the people at Hardee's while we waited for the caravan to come get us. We saw a unified effort in the beginning. And it's almost like this trip, this bus being on fire, symbolizes what we were going to present in a real-life scenario. And people who care, there was folk from Trinity Episcopal Church that was in their own cars and others in their cars, turned around and told our seniors. My point being is that the healing process of when we come together, like-minded people who have compassion and care, and not let our differences divide us, but what unifies us, we couldn't have scripted that. We had a great plan. We had a great presentation. But what happened and what's happening is that there's a healing that takes place. I was four when Florida Memorial left. But there's people, my dad went to college there. There's a generation of folks that remember. Greg them marched because they was in high school and remembered the hatred. But now, remember Dr. King said that his dream was that his children, little black boys and little black girls, would be able to come together? We are doing that right now at a time when our country needs that. A time when our countries need to say that we can have our different religions, our political aspirations, but we are still, the American story is built on pain, and it can also be built on a healing of that pain. And that's why I think St. John's County has to be the place, you know what I'm saying, to allow this museum and for the healing to take place throughout the country and the world itself. That's amazing, I think.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're talking about St. John's County's effort to become home to the state's Museum of Black History, and you can join our conversation on social media or by emailing firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also call 904-549-2937. We have a call from Shamari in West Jacksonville. Good morning. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Good morning. Good morning. And I think this is a great conversation, great topic today. And I just wanted to add, maybe I missed it, hopefully not, but I just wanted to add a bit of information to this. It's so relevant for the site to be in St. Augustine because of the connectivity to Jacksonville. And I don't know if it's been noted, but Florida Memorial, as the Florida Baptist Institute, was actually founded further up here between Jacksonville and Live Oak. And the groups, the individuals who were a part of that group who founded Florida Baptist Institute, a majority of them were from Jacksonville, and they were Baptist preachers. And one of the main Baptist churches that funded and really supported that effort was First Baptist Church of Oakland over on the east side, the Lewises and the Cobbs and the Sams families were a great part of that. So I just wanted to make sure we add that it's not just that campus in St. Augustine, but the connectivity is also there with Jacksonville.
Excellent comment, Shamar. I appreciate that. We also have a call from Michael in Duval County. Good morning, Michael. Go ahead.
Good morning. I wish the St. Augustine delegation well. It's a wonderful thing to see this museum coming to fruition. But I do have to say that there's a good case to be made for Eatonville being the site. Eatonville was the location of the first all-black township. It's well known due to the being the place where Zora Neale Hurston was raised, and is known to the public because of that. And I also must say, a lot of the St. Augustine history is negative. After Fort Mose, lots of bad things happened. So I wish them well, and I'm looking forward to see what the decision is. But they have some competition from Eatonville. Thank you.
Good comment. Thanks, Michael. Well, we should note, so St. Augustine is in first place, but there are Eatonville / Orange County is a close second, followed by Opa-locka and then Sarasota. So the top three are essentially chosen by the task force, and those recommendations will go to the governor?
Yes.
Yeah. What happens now, between now and then?
So we essentially are be on standby. We're standby. The task force has essentially deployed FAMU to take on a conceptual design and some site evaluation.
That's Florida,
in the next 30
Florida
days.
A&M University.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. Thank you. So they are going to do some evaluation on the specific proposed sites, including West Augustine, the Memorial University site as well for 14.5 acres. And then the team of the design team will bring their report back to the task force members. And the task force members will make its final recommendation to the governor's office. I believe the next task force meeting is on May 21st. So we're expecting to hear more about the details of next step. But I will be highly surprised if St. Johns County is not going to be ending up on the governor's desk.
All right. We have a call from Susan in Fruit Cove. Good morning, Susan. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I just am so pleased about all the work that all different groups across St. Augustine and West St. Augustine, and I just think the whole effort has highlighted the fact that St. Augustine is a compassionate city. And I just can't say enough positive about how all different people from all walks of life. I live way up north, but we go monthly to a meeting called Good Trouble. And some of the people from Good Trouble were on the bus going to Tallahassee. And I'm just so pleased that our efforts of trying to understand all different points of view are finally being heard. So I just am so, so grateful for your reporting. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan. We appreciate it, too. Good Trouble, of course, is a famous quote by John Lewis, American civil rights leader and elected official. This is meaningful on a lot of levels, Joy, but it's also an economic boon, or it would be expected to. So what does the money side of this mean for the county?
Well, if I can address that from sort of two different aspects, one is number one really is why, from economical perspective, this is a location that is going to speak for longevity and vibrancy and sustainability. We are looking at around 10 million visitors annually to St. Augustine, St. Johns County. And 44% of those visitors are reported to come here for history, for cultural, for heritage. So previously, the caller had a great case about Eatonville and in the comparison of it. And as we all know, that when we go to Orange County, Orlando, most of us go there for a very different reason. And so we feel like this is the place to be, to celebrate, to recognize, to honor, and acknowledge really the context of the Black history. So the tourism stats speaks volume for the suitability for St. Johns County, St. Augustine. But as the sort of the result of this location for St. Augustine, especially West Augustine community, is going to be so monumental. It's going to change the community for its generations to come. I think the economic benefits it is going to bring for the community, for West Augustine community, and really for the community as a whole, for Northeast Florida. We are the first coast, the first coasting site, essentially. So we really are looking at a enormous economic impact regionally. And we're talking about Duval County, we're talking about Clay County, St. John's County, Flagler County. As we started with this journey, the supports from these surrounding counties just flooded in. We received Mayor Donald Deegan's support. As you know, we're talking about earlier, another caller had talked about the connection to Jacksonville. One of the task force members, Representative Michael, she represents Jacksonville, and she very early on indicated her support for St. John's County. So the transportation, the connection to surrounding counties as a region, I think we can all see huge benefit as a result of this location selection.
We have a call from Stanley on the north side. Good morning, Stanley. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I want to say I am impressed with St. Augustine and St. John County. I have attended other events, and when it comes to history and bringing people together, I am impressed with St. John's County. And whatever we can do, I'm talking about the metro area, what we can do to improve the area and bring history for all people, we need to do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Stanley. Pastor Britton, you know, there are a lot of historic sites in St. Augustine. Obviously, there's this, you know, the ancient city kind of element, which has traditionally been the focus. It seems only very recently that the city has begun to reckon with its civil rights history and that very difficult period. What do you think is bringing that about, that change, that willingness to engage and look at that very dark chapter?
The timing is right. I think the George Floyd incident and some others that have taken place over the last few years have woke up the soul of America. It's not that we have a black problem, but we have a problem as a people, as a nation, as a race. And so the years of suffering, the years of persecution, the timing is right. And that's something you can't plan for. When is the time right? And I think that as a country, what we have experienced and the pain that we have experienced is creating this need for compassion. We need one another. George said something this morning. We are people, not black, not white, who care. And when you get a group of people who care, that's on the same page with one voice, one vision, it creates a volume. And then when our political elective officials, when the people who incorporate America in every phase of our society say, listen, this is important. Let's make it a priority. The timing is right. And you can't script that. It just is. And I think that that's why today we're open to saying, listen, America's story, America history, black history is as much part of that as Native Americans, Italian Americans, and so forth and so on. The timing is right, I think.
Gotcha. We have a call, Eugene, from the north side. Good morning, Eugene. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning, all. Hopefully you can hear me clearly. My vote, I'm more so leaning toward Eatonville because I think the square footage is there. The location is great. And downside I see to St. Augustine is too small. It's not going to be accommodating. And let's just call a spade a spade. The powers that be, they're looking at this from an economic standpoint. This is just pad the pockets of the powers that be once again.
Eugene, thank you. We're having a little trouble hearing you, but I think we got the message. Also have a call from Jerry in St. Augustine. Good morning, Jerry. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Hi. This is a great idea. The location is perfect on the vacated college, and especially with Fort Mosaic in town, which was, I believe, the first free black community in the country.
That's correct.
Okay. And also it would be nice to show the history of something else in St. Augustine besides the colonialism. And one more point.
Jerry, I think we're going to have to leave it there just because of the noise in the background. So, Joy, is there an opportunity for involvement at this point for citizens? Should they be doing anything, or do you feel like the work is done?
Absolutely. If I may, the next 30 days is the most critical time for St. John's County, St. Augustine, in competition, essentially with Edenville. So anything any individual out there can do to help us to advocate for St. John's County, there is a contact that we can share with, and I can share that with you, Anne. So I don't
know.
You
can share it on air if you'd like.
Okay. I would have to probably look it up and make sure that we have the right address. I don't want
to. We can post it to our website later.
We did have task force did a survey a while back, and I don't know if it's still ongoing or not, but we are still actively soliciting support letters from different organizations, educational institution, faith-based groups, really any organizations that you feel like that you will play a part in this. We welcome you. We want you to be there.
That's excellent. Well, thank you so much, Pastor Anthony Britton and Joy Andrews. We really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You bet. And up next, college students in Jacksonville take on real-world research in the hope of making a global impact. Welcome back. A new State Department program at FSCJ will give local students a chance to impact global diplomacy. It's called the Diplomacy Lab. It's one of more than 60 at colleges around the country, but it's just the third in Florida. And I'm joined now by two faculty guides for the school's new Diplomacy Lab. Julia Montgomery, FSCJ Professor of Art and Design, welcome.
Hello.
And Dr. Daniel Cronrath, a familiar face and voice on the station, Professor of Political Science at FSCJ. Welcome.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. So this sounds so cool. How did FSCJ land this program, and when does it get rolling?
Julia?
All right. Well, we actually were lucky enough to have a colleague at FSCJ provide this program to us. She is currently working at the State Department as well as with FSCJ. And when she found out about Diplomacy Lab, she thought it would be the perfect fit. So she brought it to us and kind of gave us courses in understanding what it was and what we were going to be needing to do with our students. And from there, we just kind of hit the ground running.
So. And so what is it? And what are you going to need to do with your students?
So Diplomacy Lab is basically a project brought on by the State Department to connect both the private and public sector. And so essentially students are given real world projects from the State Department. And these projects, they're on a variety of subjects. So they can be from like democracy initiatives to voting rights to climate change to marketing, which is what I'm doing. But essentially students are given these projects. They work with the State Department and a faculty supervising them throughout. And at the end of it, they get to put the State Department as their client on their resume. So it's a really big deal for our students.
That's extraordinary. And Daniel, how is it that the school, do you have to apply? Do you have to compete in order to get to be one of these Diplomacy Lab locations?
Yes, we applied. It's important, you know, for folks to realize that FSCJ, we're the first open access or community college in the United States, has been selected for this program. Julia and I had an opportunity to travel with some other FSCJ folks up to Washington, D.C. and see the student presentations this year in preparation for our students maybe going next year. Just the creativity, the idea of FSCJ being in the room with groups from Johns Hopkins, from American University, from George Washington University, really puts our institution in an elite company. And our students are going to be up for the task.
That's very prestigious. And the projects are really interesting. So I was looking through a list of them, and they are, as you said, so varied, including, and a lot of them seem to focus on social media and ways that students can help the State Department by researching, for instance, in Jamaica, they're trying to reduce scams that also impact U.S. citizens. And so, you know, how to communicate with people there, perhaps younger people there that are being drawn into the criminal underworld. It was sort of, but there's also projects all over the world that they're asking local students to help research and presumably provide some answers.
Right. And programmatically, how it works is the State Department will put out opportunities for colleges to bid on those projects. So, for example, my project, which is called Vias for Voting, we're going to be working to develop an interactive tool for officers who are working in Central America to learn more about the election systems, where they're going to be stationed. Obviously, coming from the United States with a federal form of government and with our own unique election style with the Electoral College and other elements, it's going to be very, very different where they're going. So our students will do the research, they'll put together, and then they will have a tool that they can use in perpetuity in the field to provide them with information about where they're going to be working for the United States.
So the project list comes from the State Department. The teachers, if they're interested, bid. And if they're fortunate, they win the project. Their students can then participate. And so students get credit for this. Is it a semester long, or does a project pass from class to class?
So that really depends on the institution, on the instructor. For me personally, it is a course. So I teach in the digital media program, and I teach at both the associate's and bachelor's level. And so this particular course is a bachelor's level course called Digital Media Creative Problem Solving. And the learning outcomes just happen to align perfectly with the project that we're working on.
What is the project?
So we're going to be essentially researching the marketing and branding for an area of the State Department called American Spaces. And American Spaces are throughout the world. They can be hosted in embassies or freestanding. There's something like over 600 spaces throughout the world. But they provide education to foreigners on the American way of life. So they provide classes in learning English. They provide classes in learning our civic structure, skill-based classes on, you know, different areas of employment, and also free internet access and open internet access in locations that don't always offer that. So we are going to be researching those spaces, the regions in which they are currently held, and then providing an audit and report on the branding, as well as students are going to be rebranding the marketing, the logo, and all that for American Spaces.
Fascinating. So is that's a semester long project?
Yes, it is.
And how many credits do students get for that?
So they get 3 credits.
Wow, that's really interesting. And so do you expect other teachers at the school, other professors are going to be seeking to bid on these other projects? I mean, there's a whole long list of projects that people can bid on. So you're the first two?
Yes, yes. And we expect that there's going to be bids which are appropriate for a lot of our different programs at FSCJ, not just American government or international relations, but our workforce programs, that we can try to find a way to perform projects in the field that will help meet our students where they're at and give them the opportunity in our AS programs and our BAS programs like Julia teaches in. I think really the sky is the limit. I think to be able to attend an affordable institution like FSCJ and yet have the opportunity to have this on your resume moving forward. The other thing I would stress too is that a lot of the people now who are working for a diplomacy lab or working for the State Department were in the diplomacy lab at one point. This is for students looking for a career to work for the Department of State. This can be a direct jumping point. You know, if you wanted to live your life overseas, serving your country in some sort of capacity, the diplomacy lab would be an on-ramp for that.
And so is this for a certain level of student? I mean, some people come and take classes just to learn more about a subject at FSCJ and maybe aren't full-time students. Who's eligible? And do you have to be a certain, you know, level of, you know, certain year?
For me personally, I wanted my bachelor's students to do it because they're interested in this. They're wanting experiential learning, especially at that level where the class is offered. And this is definitely an experiential learning experience. I think I said experience twice there. I think in terms of that student population, it's perfect. But it does depend because students can work in groups. You know, you can, in some universities and colleges, they actually have diplomacy lab departments where it's more student focused and run. So it is dependent upon the school.
But it's right. Not like you have to be a senior or...
No, you just have to be, you know, signing up for a class that's eventually going to be offering it. A lot of these questions, Anne, are like questions that we've been asking ourselves, too.
Yes.
Sometimes when you're really excited for something, here's a little, view behind the scenes. Sometimes teachers have to figure things out as we go along.
Right.
And we try to invent these things and then integrate them into our classroom. But I think it's been the intention from the institution immediately to have these opportunities open to any one of our students. It's not based upon GPA. It's not based upon pre-qualification. If you're a student at FSCJ, if you're pursuing your AA, in the future, hopefully you'll be able to look at the course schedule, recognize Diplomacy Lab as being part of that course, and give yourself an opportunity by the way, there's no guarantee that the bid will be accepted. For example, in my case, the individual who put out our bid, there were three institutions that were selected. So understand it's us, American University, and Johns Hopkins. I mean, that's the company that our students are going to be keeping with students from those other institutions. It's really an amazing opportunity.
It really is an extraordinary program.
It is. It absolutely
must be very exciting.
Yeah.
We are.
Well, thanks so much for coming on to talk to us about it today. Is there a way that people could find more information if they wanted to?
I know we have a Diplomacy Lab website available. Honestly, if you just Google FSCJ Diplomacy Lab, it will take you directly to the site. So that's one way where you can learn a little bit about it.
There'll also be a link on there to the Department of State's Diplomacy Lab website where folks can peruse and see what the various opportunities are out there, which, again, this is all in the service of our individuals who are working for the United States and the Department of State. It's making their jobs easier through our classrooms.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Julia D'Arriba Montgomery and Dr. Daniel Conrath. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you, Ian.
Thank you so much.
And stick around. We'll be back with a preview of an event offering healing through laughter. Welcome back. National Crime Victims Week got underway Sunday with the theme of how can you help? I'm joined now by somebody who has made it his mission to help, community organizer and advocate with Crime Victims Speak, Darren Mason. Welcome, Darren.
How you doing? Good morning.
Thank you for being here. Darren, there are events this weekend that we're going to talk about, but start if you can by telling us how this subject is personal to you.
Crime Survivor Safety and Justice Organization, it nationally affects and help people just like me and other families as well. As someone who was born and raised and proud native of Jacksonville, this hits home for many reasons. As a mentor, I lost several mentees through crime violence.
You do mentoring and have done mentoring for
yes.
a while, but
yeah.
you've lost mentees.
Yeah, I started at 15 working at the Arlington Family YMCA.
Wow.
And that's where I found my passion with working with those that's been considered at risk.
Yeah. Your family also personally suffered a loss.
And so it really hit home after a while of being known as the go-to person to help with youth. Recently, 2019, I believe, or 18, I lost my little cousin at 15 here in Jacksonville. And it was supposed to be a time of transition for my family because his grandfather, my uncle, just passed away in a car accident in Virginia. And so the goal was to move the family here for healing and support. And within that time of us still grieving over his death, we lost our younger family member as well. And luckily of me being involved and engaged in the community, I was able to ask certain questions and call JSO, but still a lot of information that we were not privy to But all we knew that he was found dead in a ditch somewhere on the south side.
It's tragic, and I'm so sorry about that. This week is meant to, you know, address the community of people who've lost family members or have themselves been victims of crime. And so there are a lot of solemn events, you know, reading of names and roses that are, you know, laid down in their memory. But this weekend you have an event that is by design going to be a little more lighthearted.
Absolutely. So this Saturday, all across the country, there will be National Healing Visual Days of Action. And so the goal for Jacksonville is to just have those healing circles, acknowledge those loved ones that we lost, but it's a day of celebration. And so we're going to have, we want to take the time to heal through love, through laughter, through fun, and helping families and remind them that they can still live, that they still can have fun, and that it's okay to laugh, because a lot of victims feel guilty. They have that survivor remorse type of feeling. And so sometimes it's hard to laugh because it brings back a memory, or seeing a kid play a certain game, just certain things that does remind folks or are triggers. But we want to show folks that it's okay. It's okay to laugh again. It's okay to joke again. It's okay to play a game again, because that's where healing starts. And though, even though that everyone grieves differently, that we all can be a part of each other's healing process.
And so there's going to be activities. There's going to be, I think you said, you know, bounce houses. What all is
bounce houses? Going to be a kickball tournament. So I'm super excited, because whatever team I'm on, I mean, all types of stuff. So we have relay races, food, music. It's going to be a great time.
Where is it, and how can people participate?
It's going to be at the A. Philip Randolph Park on the east side of town. And it's an all day of event. So bring your lawn chairs, just come out. No tickets, no registration. We want as many people that just need a day of healing through laughter and fun.
That's the park with the Bob Hayes statue.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so is it open to anyone?
Yes.
Yep. Okay.
Yep.
Is it encouraged that families are coming with, you know, their all of their extended relatives and children?
Absolutely. And especially the children. We a lot of times when things happen, we kind of forget those that are still alive and helping them heal. Especially those, because sometimes we just say, you know, because I hear a lot, my son just doesn't want to get up for school, or, you know, that my daughter doesn't want to speak. Well, she lost her brother too, you know. And so this will be a great time if you have a young one that is not acting the same, or, you know, you're seeing some signs. This will be a first step to that healing journey for them as well.
National Day of Healing, Saturday. What time does it start?
It starts at 10 o'clock.
All right. Well, Darren Mason, thanks so much for sharing your story and for being here today.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Up next, bringing awareness to the climate crisis through poetry.
North Florida TPO, proud sponsor of WJCT's First Coast Connect, bringing to the community innovation in transportation planning, commuter services, clean fuels, and intelligent transportation systems. More at northfloridatpo.com.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at lifesouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
It's been nearly 2 years since Eastern Kentucky was hit with historic rain and flooding. Residents missed appeals deadlines without realizing it.
People will come 3 years down the line and say, hey, I want to appeal FEMA. and they can't.
I'm Juana Summers, exploring the challenges of receiving disaster aid on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
In Wyoming, new local grocery stores are paving the way for small producers to sell beyond the farmer's market or roadside stand.
Provides them a lot more flexibility. They may have young kids, they gotta go feed their cows. They don't need to be here to sell their product.
I'm Kimberly Adams. What the changes mean for the local food economy. Next time on Marketplace.
Tonight at 6 on WJCT News 89.9.
The peak of Mount Everest is the tallest point on Earth at 29,000 feet. Before the first known summit in 1953, most considered the climb impossible. Now, 7,000 have done it. The vast majority hired help from Nepal and Tibet. What does it take for humans to stand on the top of the world? Next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. You may not automatically think of the climate crisis as artistic inspiration, but in fact, it's the foundation of an effort to unite poetry of young writers with the music of masters. And to discuss it, I'm joined now by violinist Andy Bruck. He's the president of the Musicians Association of Jacksonville. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have you. What motivated local musicians, this is the Local Musicians Union, to orchestrate this seemingly very ambitious project?
Actually, this is something that sort of synergizes a lot of my passions, including music education, the United Nations, poetry, and I became aware of how stressed that youth are around the world about the climate crisis, and I thought let's create something constructive that can be sort of a partnership between that would motivate student creativity with some of the support from the professional music world.
And so the students are tasked with what exactly?
They can submit poems in two categories. The first is a written poem of 100 to 300 words. The other category is spoken word, up to 3 minute a video.
Uh-huh. And so they make their submissions and then... And they're supposed to be on the topic of climate change, is that right?
That's correct.
But they're not to music.
They will not. They're not to music. But the grand prize winner in the written poem will get their music set to classical soundtrack, and it'll kind of like the Aaron Copland Lincoln Portrait idea. And we were able to secure a grant from Jacksonville University, the Climate Innovation Challenge Grant. And that's going to fund the commissioning of the composer William Boston, as well as the recording. We'll make a professional recording by members of the Musicians Union.
So that's really interesting. Tell us a little bit about who William Boston is.
He is he's a JU graduate, and
interesting. So they're funding the grant, and this would actually go to one of their students in some way.
Yes, that's correct. And then he has. Among his notable accomplishments is that he composed a short series of light classical miniatures with the, his work was recorded by the English Chamber Orchestra. He also worked with the Star Trek Enterprise composer Velton Ray Bunch as a music associate. So he has quite a background.
Interesting. Well, let's take a listen to one of William Boston's compositions. So, Andy, why focus on the climate crisis? I know you said it's your interest and you're concerned about anxiety that youth are having over the issue, but it does seem like a tall topic to tackle in poetry, perhaps not. I don't know.
For me, it's such an overarching issue in just personally, the climate crisis. And it just seems like every couple of days there's some new, you know, huge story about it. It's just, and I just really felt like we just need hundreds, thousands of people thinking about this issue and applying their creativity. And if it's going to take just a global effort to, I think, to solve it, to address it.
Do you think that music and poetry in some ways have the power to connect individuals to nature or just even to the larger universe?
Absolutely. Actually, it's almost like you read my mind here. That one of my favorite influences is the author Daisaku Ikeda, and he has actually written about the poetic spirit, and he said that it fuses the pulse of the human heart with the rhythm of nature and the universe, and it also has the power to retune and reconnect a discordant, divided world. And then also just the music and words have a really powerful synergy in themselves. At my grant presentation, I shared a quote. Let's see if I can find it. It was some research that was done that just shows how powerful the combination of music is. It increases the flow of blood to the brain, and it just wakens the emotions, and it just seems like awakening a sense of caring is really what's most crucial here.
So kids who enter, there actually is a cash reward if they win. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, we have three prizes in each of those two categories. So a $500, a $300, and a $100 prize.
So that's for the written and the spoken word?
Correct. Yes.
And how is the winner determined?
We have, for the written, we have four judges. We have two of them are from UNF. They're in English department. We have one from JU, and we also have another poet from kind of independent outside of the university.
Just briefly, how can people make a submission?
They want to visit our website, which is jacksmusic444.com, and then go to the climate crisis section of the website, and they can click on to submit their form and learn more about it.
Andy Brook, thank you so much for being here, and that's our program. Join us again tomorrow when we examine the complicated life and continuing legacy of local poet Alan Justice. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.